John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.immc.org, for February 13th to the 19th, 2010. As Palestinian factions meet in Gaza for talks over national unity, Israeli attacks continued this week in both the West Bank and Gaza. These stories and more coming up, stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report with the nonviolent activities in the West Bank with IMEMC's Ghassan Banoura.
All over the West Bank, Israeli troops used tear gas and sound bombs to suppress anti-wall protests. On Friday, the people of Bel'in, a small Palestinian village in the central West Bank, marked the fifth year anniversary of their weekly struggle against the Israeli-built wall on their lands. Villagers, along with international and Israeli supporters, marched after the midday prayers at the local mosque towards the Israeli-built wall. In 2004, the International Court of Justice in The Hague ruled the Israeli wall illegal. In September 2007, the villagers continued to protest and, through legal proceedings, managed to get the Israeli Supreme Court of Justice to order a halt to the wall's construction. The court ruled for a rerouting of the wall section built on Bel'in's land. Due to the ruling, the villagers got back 270 acres of the 600 acres the wall was planned to take over. This week, after 2 years of stalling, the Israeli military started to reroute the wall as ordered by the court. Iyad Burnat, head of the Bel'in Committee Against the Wall and Settlements, stated,
"The creative ideas the local popular committee did, along with Bel'in's residents in resisting the wall, attracted a lot of international supporters and media, which helped spreading this experience.
Since the start of the protest 5 years ago at the Bel'in village, Israeli and international supporters joined the villagers' struggle. Shai Polak, an Israeli activist who comes to Bel'in every week.
In the beginning, the first role of the Israelis was to try to lower the amount of violence from the army, because the army have different open fire orders. If they are like only Palestinians, it's very, very dangerous. And then, of course, after many years of working together, there are like other issues, like we are building like a movement of joint struggle, that struggle against the wall and the occupation generally.
Villagers all over the West Bank followed Bil'in's footsteps in conducting weekly protests against the Israeli-built wall on their lands. Salah Al-Khawaja from the nearby Na'lin village, where anti-wall protests started 3 years ago.
There were three key elements that succeeded in Bil'in: continuity, diversity, and self-dependent, which Na'lin, Al-Masara, and Susia have learned from.
The Israeli military have arrested at least 128 villagers from all over the West Bank in the past 6 months in connection to the weekly anti-wall protest. Currently, Israel's army is holding at least 6 members of the Popular Committee Against the Wall and Settlements under charges of incitement against the military. Iyad Burnat, head of the Bil'in Committee Against the Wall and Settlements, reported.
They try to stop us by force, by nightly invasions and arrests. They even tried to kill people, and they did. They killed our friend Basim in April of last year to try to stop this weekly activity. We say our protest will continue and will not stop until the wall is gone.
Every week, an Israeli army unit stops the villagers from going through the gate of the wall by firing tear gas canisters, causing dozens to suffer gas inhalation. On Friday, at least 3 residents were injured by rubber-coated steel bullets. Dozens more were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. The army also used liquid tear gas. For this Friday, the protest ended at the village of Bil'in. But before dispersing, the villagers take a final look at the tombstone of Basim Abu Rahma, a local popular resistance activist killed by the Israeli forces last year. In total, the army injured 1,200 people from the village during the weekly protests started 5 years ago. For IMEMC.org, this is Ghassan Bannoura.
On the 12th of February, West Bank Palestinians marched on the apartheid wall, many of them dressed as the Na'vi from the movie Avatar, calling the Israelis the Sky People, who were the occupiers in that movie.
We are here, Avatars and Na'vis, fighting against the Sky People, who are taking our land, occupying our people.
Did it work?
And we are here to send a message that this is our land, and these trees, they do not belong to the Sky People, and they need to be returned to their owners. If you look at it in a naive way, it talks about the occupied, oppressed people fighting against the occupier, the ruthless occupier, which is basically what's happening here in Bil'in. The only problem is that it's a Hollywood movie, but here, as opposed to Hollywood, this is real.
So to everybody, that they can take whatever they want.
What is that new?
And no one can stop them.
So move on.
But we will send them a message. And we will show the Sky People that they cannot take whatever they want.
Soldiers of Israel didn't like this message very much, and they opened up on peaceful Palestinian protesters with tear gas and other projectiles. protesters shook off the effects of the gas and the so-called bad smell water that the Israelis always fire at them in the town of Baleen, and continued their march on the apartheid or separation wall that the Israelis have built to separate the people of Palestine from their land.
The battle for Marja, launched on February 13th by a combined force of more than 15,000, including U.S. Marines, Afghan soldiers, and British troops, is the first major battle following President Obama's escalation of the war in Afghanistan. The goal, according to U.S. officials, is to rout the Taliban from the area and then secure and hold the city. The strategy depends on cooperation from Afghan civilians, and there are reports that many civilians are willing to take steps to push the Taliban out of their communities by reporting their whereabouts to Western military authorities and by refusing to give Taliban insurgents food or shelter. A cornerstone of the effort is to build trust among citizens and avoid civilian casualties. However, in the first days of the assault, a dozen people were reported killed, including at least five children, in one location, and other non-combatant deaths soon followed. In other news from Afghanistan, a joint raid by Pakistan and U.S. intelligence officers reportedly captured the Taliban's top military commander in the Pakistani city of Karachi. But it is uncertain if that arrest would affect the Taliban's capabilities on the battlefield. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Robert Naiman, policy director of Just Foreign Policy, which uses online tools to promote citizen activism in the realm of U.S. foreign policy. He explains how Obama's escalation of the war in Afghanistan may not bring about his desired results.
Before the offensive happened, U.S. officials said civilian casualties were inevitable, and of course that was exactly true. The U.S. military forces were going into a densely populated area. It's estimated the population of Marja was between 80,000 and 100,000, and it was reported that most of the civilians had not fled the town. The instruction from the NATO forces to the civilian population was stay in your homes and keep your head down. So that was it. These 12 civilians that were killed, I don't know for sure, but at least five children, according to the New York Times account, they were inside. They were obeying the NATO instructions, and obviously that didn't save them from the U.S. rocket attack. There's no explanation that's been given for why this military assault in the civilian area is justified, given the cost to civilians. Remember that U.S. officials have said that at the end of the day, the way that this is going to be resolved in Afghanistan is not by a U.S. military victory. They've conceded that the U.S. cannot defeat the Taliban militarily. They've conceded that the Afghan Taliban are a permanent part of the political landscape in Afghanistan. They concede that the end game is going to be a negotiated political agreement. So the thing that they haven't explained is how the agreement that they could get 12 months from now, 18 months from now, whenever it is different from the agreement that they could get by starting negotiations today. The Afghan government, President Karzai, has said that he wants political talks now, peace talks now, with the senior Afghan Taliban leadership. This is a policy that's been opposed by the United States. So these deaths that are happening now, the deaths of Afghans, deaths, of course, of American soldiers, these additional deaths from the present policy of military escalation can only be justified if you explain what the difference is between the political settlement that's going to result a year from now and the political settlement that could happen today.
Obama is saying the surge will turn the tide, but if the administration concedes all those things about the Taliban, then why do you think he's really doing the surge?
According to them, their logic is they don't want the deal that they could get now they say, you know, our position is too weak, the Taliban's position is too strong, and we don't want to negotiate from a position of weakness. So first we have to weaken the Taliban. But they haven't explained to the American people or to Congress what that is. The security objective, the U.S. national security objective that's been identified by U.S. officials is, you know, it's all about the relationship between the Taliban and al-Qaeda, and it's all about Afghanistan being a base for attacks on the United States. There is strong reason to believe, with considerable evidence, that those two things are things that the United States could be negotiating with the Afghan Taliban leadership today. The fact that the United States is not doing that indicates that maybe they have some other objective that they haven't told us besides the relationship between the Taliban and al-Qaeda and the potential threat of Afghanistan being a base of attacks on the U.S. in the future. But that's a question mark because the U.S. officials have never been compelled to answer this question.
But the U.S. has acknowledged that very few members of al-Qaeda remain in Afghanistan. They're all in Pakistan.
Yes, absolutely. Admiral Mullen, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in congressional testimony, said, you know, we estimate that there's not more than 100 al-Qaeda people in Afghanistan. Which, of course, that's an embarrassing confession for the U.S., given its policy. You know, we have tens of thousands of ground forces in Afghanistan, and we have, you know, a handful of forces in Pakistan, none of whom are, at least officially, allowed to engage in any kind of combat. The only thing that the U.S. is officially, or semi-officially engaged in is this program of drone strikes in Pakistan. So in the place where the al-Qaeda is believed to be in Pakistan, there's no U.S. war there. In the case where al-Qaeda isn't, there is. In Afghanistan, there is a war. It seems like on the surface of it, it appears that the logic is just inertia. You know, we're already doing it, and we can do it, and so we'll continue to do it until such point as we can do something that we can call victory. But that's not a moral, not a moral basis for what we're doing, which involves, you know, continued deaths of U.S. soldiers and Afghan civilians and billions of dollars every month. The fact that we're doing it already is not a sufficient justification for continuing to do it in the future.
That was Robert Naiman with the group Just Foreign Policy. For more information, visit the group's website at justforeignpolicy.org.
That is the sound of the U.S. offensive in Marja, Afghanistan, bogging down. NATO is reporting the deaths of two occupation soldiers in a bomb attack Sunday, February 21st. NATO is reporting the death of another occupation soldier in another IED attack on Saturday, February 20th. NATO is reporting the death of an occupation soldier in an indirect fire, that means artillery, mortar, or rocket, on Sunday, February the 21st. In addition to the hornet's nest of bombs and booby traps, insurgent snipers are turning Marja into a mountain Stalingrad. NATO is reporting the death of an occupation soldier from the small arms fire attack in an undisclosed area of southern Afghanistan on Thursday, February 18th. NATO is reporting the death of another occupation soldier from a small arms fire attack in southern Afghanistan on Friday, February 19th. Meanwhile, the Afghan government says a NATO airstrike has killed at least 33 civilians in southern Afghanistan. The Council of Ministers released a statement Monday condemning the attack as unjustifiable. The Dutch government has just been reconstituted after its previous governing majority collapsed over the Afghan war. The new government is removing all Dutch troops from Afghanistan. Just like Iraq, the coalition is becoming smaller one country at a time. Speaking of Iraq, the past weekend was no fun for U.S. forces there either. Iraq, Sunday, multinational force Iraq, meaning the U.S. military, is reporting the deaths of two Army helicopter pilots in a helicopter crash near an airfield on an undisclosed U.S. base in northern Iraq. Baghdad, Iraq, Monday. Five civilians were wounded when several mortars hit Baghdad's heavily fortified green zone. which is home to several foreign embassies and government departments, according to an Interior Ministry official. These civilians could be contractors or employees of the puppet regime. Baghdad, Iraq, Monday. Two mortar rounds landed in or near a former Saddam security complex, now used as a U.S. base. No casualties were reported. The sectarian war that drenched Iraq in blood during 2006 to 2007 seems to be heating up again, too. Baghdad, Iraq, Monday. Gunmen shot and killed eight members of the same family and beheaded some of them on Monday in a mainly Sunni Muslim district southeast of Baghdad, according to a security official. Quote, unknown gunmen killed eight members of the same family with silencers and cut the heads off some of the bodies, the Office of Baghdad Security spokesman Major General Qasem al-Masawi said in a statement. The attack took place about 7 a.m. local time in the Al-Wadi neighborhood of the Medine district outside Baghdad. No further details were given. Mr. Barack Obama, now is the time to get the hell out of the Middle East. Bring all the troops home from all the wars. This is what the people who voted you into office were voting for. Not more war. This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Welcome to War of the Trees on WSQT Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington.
There is unrest in the forest. There is trouble with the trees. For the maples want more sunlight, and the oaks ignore their pleas.
In a world of corporate domination and utter ruin, whosoever shall have the courage to take direct action against those who are ruining our planet and our very lives. Whale Wars Update. Japan's illegal whaling fleet has been unable to kill a whale since February 5th, having been under continuous attack by Sea Shepherd, like in Whale Wars, since that date. That is now 18 days with no whales killed. The Sea Shepherd ship Bob Barker is under new command, as her previous captain is now a hostage aboard the Shonan Maru No. 2, headed back to Japan. This trip, several weeks long, effectively removes the Shonan Maru No. 2 from the battlefield for the remaining duration of the season, which ends in a few weeks. Here is an interview taken by another radio station with Captain Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd ship Steve Irwin concerning the fate of the Bob Barker's previous captain, now a hostage bound for Japan.
Captain Bethune boarded the Japanese whaling fleet security vessel Shonan Maru under cover of darkness while it was going along at full speed. It was a very courageous thing and very risky, but he got on board, and he was on board for an hour and a half before he was discovered. He was discovered by simply knocking on the door of the bridge house wheel door and presenting himself. We had that covered by video from our helicopter. He went on board to deliver a message asking the captain of the Shonan Maru to go to the nearest New Zealand and Australia port to turn himself in for sinking the Adi Gil and for the attempted murder of six of the Adi Gil crew members. And then the Japanese took him into custody and detained him, and I understand they're on their way to Japan, which I find absolutely amazing that they're sending in a ship for 3 weeks just to carry one person prisoner back to Japan.
And just for a moment to back up a second, it stems from an incident on January 6, 2010 this year. What happened then?
On January 6, the Adi Gil, the Sea Shepherd vessel, it's a fast patrol boat, was sitting still in the water when the Shonamaru number 2 came by, deliberately turned into it, rammed it, cut it in half, sunk it, and destroyed it, and nearly missed killing 6 of the crew on board. It was registered in New Zealand. New Zealand did nothing, not even a reprimand or a rebuke to Japan for this, and so Peter Bethune, as a New Zealand citizen, decided that since his government wasn't going to represent his interests, he went on board the Shonamaru to demand that the captain of the Shonamaru address that crime.
And as you say, Peter Bethune is reportedly on his way back to Japan now, possibly to face charges. What would be the charges that he would face?
Well, that'd be very interesting. I can't see what charges he could possibly face. He simply went on board the vessel to present a message to the captain about the sinking of his vessel, the Audie Gill. The Japanese are talking about charging with piracy. I find it highly ludicrous after that ship had sunk his vessel that they would charge him with piracy for basically protesting the fact that the ship was sunk. They're also saying that he injured 3 crew members on the Shonan Maru number 2 on February 11th. They accused him of throwing butyric acid or rotten butter into their face, which caused eye damage. But as it is, we actually videotaped that, and it's on our website. The injuries were self-inflicted when the Japanese tried to hit our crew with pepper spray. And you can see on the video, they pull the trigger on their canisters of pepper spray. The wind blows it back in their faces. You see them rubbing their eyes and obviously irritated. So we have the evidence that, in fact, those injuries were self-inflicted. So that would be a very easy charge for Peter to defend himself on.
Now, to get some context into what is going on, there is a ban on commercial whaling, but Japan has an exception to that. Can you explain what that exception is?
They don't have an exception. They say they have an exception, but it's not as simple as that. They're targeting endangered whales, that is, fin whales, and protected whales, minke whales. They're also targeting humpback whales, which are endangered, in an established international whale sanctuary in violation of a global moratorium on whaling and in violation of the Antarctic Treaty. Now, Japan argues, well, they have a right to do this for so-called scientific research, although they have produced a single peer-reviewed international scientific paper in 23 years. But even if they had the right, say, to do it for scientific research, they're in violation of the Antarctic Treaty, which prohibits commercial activity in the Southern Ocean. This is a sanctuary. You don't kill whales in a sanctuary. And they're also in contempt of the Australian Federal Court, which has ruled that they are prohibited from killing whales in the Australian Antarctic Territory, and they ignored that. So what they're doing is criminal. They are poachers. They are no different than poachers who kill elephants in East Africa, except East African elephant poachers are black and they're poor. That's the only difference.
That's Captain Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd ship Steve Irwin. He spoke to us by satellite phone from his ship about recent actions against Japanese whaling practices.
On February 21st, the Bob Barker again put points on the board with a laser attack on the factory whaling or butchering ship Nishan Maru. The laser does not generally cause permanent eye damage, but will cause several minutes of flash blindness. This follows weeks of stinky butyric acid bottles and other projectiles fired from T-shirt cannon on all Sea Shepherd vessels the way you'd use anti-tank rockets. Again, they have caused no human injuries, but have prevented the whalers from killing any more whales. Eye injuries blamed on butyric acid turned out to be caused by the whalers' own pepper spray blowing back on them in the wind. With Sea Shepherd nowhere near out of fuel and the Antarctic summer ending, the whalers may well be done for the year. If so, they will return to Japan with their smallest catch ever, yielding a huge economic loss that could sink Japan's whaling program for good. So the whales, they formed a union, and they sailed into the fight. Loaded with torpedoes, and they vowed to set things right. But now there's no more whale slaughter, where the sea shepherds they sail, and the whalers they are sinking, while laser smells and ram. On the 20th of February, animal rights protesters returned to Neiman Marcus in Washington, D.C., and to Andriana's Furs to demand that Neiman Marcus stop selling fur and Andriana's Furs go out of business.
People out here buying ridiculous clothing that kills animals.
Our customer, we haven't had a customer for a while.
Well, that's the point. Yeah, we're hoping that if you drop the fur off your shelves, then we'll be glad to stop coming back here.
You're well aware that that's exactly why we're out here, and we will not back down until you take the fur off your shelves. Because Neiman Carcass, you're great! You're false! You're fur! You're false!
Right, Neiman Marcus, it is your fault that 50 animals are being killed for every fur coat you sell. And Andriana's Furs, don't think we've forgotten about you either and your false promises to close last year. Some security boneheaded Andriana's had the nerve to threaten protesters with the FBI when it was clear from the lack of arrest that there was no arrest warrant.
When you are on the FBI, is coming to get you. I know what he has done.
What?
I know what they have done. FBI is after
you. We know what you do. You don't help FBI.
Yeah. Andriana's Furs, Neiman Marcus, you know the FBI can't protect you from the animal rights movement. They've been trying to do that for the last 20 years. If you want out, the only thing you can do is get out of the fur trade.
We'll be back! We'll be back! We won't kill you then!
The previous week, a security guard at Neiman Marcus nearly knocked out a protester's teeth, but that didn't keep people from coming back.
My whole front of all my teeth like hurt and I can taste a lot of blood.
On the 18th of February, animal rights protesters showed up at the DC offices of Novartis and AstraZeneca, 701 Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest, near the Archives Navy Memorial Metro. They were there to protest both companies' business relationship with Huntington Life Sciences, of whom both of them are major customers. Huntington Life Sciences is a contract animal testing laboratory where 500 animals are killed every day testing products like bleach and Splenda.
Again, the reason we are out here is because the offices of Novartis and AstraZeneca are both at 701 Pennsylvania Avenue. Novartis and AstraZeneca are top customers of Huntington Life Sciences, who is a contract animal testing facility who kills 500 animals each and every day to give us products that we don't need. products that animals die for, like Splenda and Bleach. This is an unethical company who kills people, kills animals, and kills the earth that we all need to live in so that they can profit and line the pockets of their CEOs. Novartis and AstraZeneca, you are doing business with a sinking ship, a company that has $100 million in debt, and they can't get listed on the stock market anymore. You need to issue an official statement severing all ties once and for all with Huntington Life Sciences. Until you do this, Novartis and AstraZeneca, we will continue to be out here each and every week, each and every month of the year, naming and shaming you. You are well aware of this. You know why we're out here. You know there's only one thing you need to do to end these protests, to ease the lives of your employees and of the rest of the company that inhabit this building. But until you do, we will not stop. If you want to get some bread,
cut your ties and then show us!
Oh, Lord, yeah!
$500
is superb!
$500
is nothing, Jay! AstraZeneca is superb!
Oh, Lord, yeah!
These corporations are getting real unhappy with the pounding they're taking from animal rights activists over their business relationship with puppy-punching Huntington Life Sciences. On the 18th of February, the head of security was inside the building reading from some kind of paper. And undercover cops in a little gold car hung back 100 yards, taking pictures from a long telephoto lens for fear that they also would be photographed and published on websites like Indie Media.
We noticed a gold car that was following and recognized a few individuals in there, and we were looking, and then it turned out they were undercover. They had big cameras, and they were taking pictures from a distance, probably about 100 yards away. They were keeping their distance, so we didn't notice them until going to Sanofi Aventis, and the head security guard was really just trying to figure out what he can do to stop the protests. He had these papers that he was looking and reading. And
you think they're trying to set up some kind of AETA thing?
I'm not sure. I think it's too early to tell at this point. It's kind of scary. Like, they're just keeping their distance now that the cops, they don't, like,
I guess they're afraid of having their faces put in public where they can be seen.
That gold car hung well back as protesters moved on from 701 Pennsylvania Avenue, where AstraZeneca and Novartis are based, to visit Sanofi of Venice in another building. Sanofi of Venice, AstraZeneca, Novartis. If you want relief from these protests, you're not going to get it from the Joint Terrorism Task Force. You're not going to get it from your security guards. You're not going to get it from the Metropolitan Police Department. If you want to be free of these protests, you need to drop Huntington Life Sciences and stop sending business to that puppy-punching, animal-torturing contract vivisection laboratory. Because in D.C. there's no sleep for the wicked. In the recent city council hearing to promote a ban on protests outside the homes of corporate executives and or a mask law, Steve Goodman, husband of Jennifer LeRae, a known target of anti-Huntington Life Sciences protests, went so far as to claim that they feared that their house would be burned down by summer unless peaceful protests outside their home were banned. I don't know about you, but I don't see how banning peaceful protests stops people from setting a fire, which is already a felony.
HLS customers that were testifying at the D.C. City Council hearing, Stephen Goodman and Brett Lambert, were pushing the council to push this push a more restrictive...
Brett Lambert? Isn't that the guy that almost got me killed?
It is. Yes. He is a piece of work. He lied. He keeps on lying. He was actually caught in court by the defense attorney, Sean Day, pointed out his lies on the stand in court, and the judge just completely, didn't take any of that in consideration.
And so what's this about them saying your houses will be burned down unless peaceful protest is banned?
They were actually saying that they need restrictive legislation so soon, because by this summer their house might be burnt down.
Well, don't they understand that in California none of that shit happened until after such a legislation was passed?
Oh yeah, they should know their history. People were actually like the Association for Biomedical Research people were actually there testifying at the DC City Council, and they were saying that in California that's the pattern that has happened and escalation.
In fact, some groups that practice armed struggle have complained that peaceful protest competes with armed action. So it would seem to me that destroying peaceful protest destroys armed action's competition. Last year, executives at AIG received huge bonuses paid for by your taxes. One AIG executive summoned the Congress to explain the bonuses, whined about getting an email saying he should be hanged from piano wire. This after AIG contributed to the Depression, perhaps more than any other corporation, and got a huge taxpayer-funded bailout paid for by your hard work. Now, AIG is about to pay another $100 million in bonuses to these same executives. This round of bonuses comes after they promised to repay last year's bonuses, said they were sorry, yet here they are again for another bite of your apple and my apple. I don't know what they've been smoking, but it sounds to me like the piano wire is about to come out again for these fat, bonus-grubbing sleazeballs at AIG's Financial Products Division. AIG can whine all they want about being bound by contract to pay these bonuses, but nothing in the contracts prohibits the U.S. government from taxing these bonuses at, say, 100%. Without that tax-funded bailout, there would be no AIG and no bonuses, so it's about time we got them back. AIG made the Depression, and we're paying them for it. AIG executives are smoking up our money and laughing in our faces. It's long past due to put these banksters in their place.